Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This podcast is a Royfield Brown production. Find others on iTunes.
All right. Yeah, I know.
Ladies and gentlemen, please remain standing for the singing of our national anthem.
Brexit means Brexit.
My administration has accomplished more than almost any administration in the history of our country.
Hello and welcome. My name is Royfield Brown. This is Mid-Atlantic, the show where we look at the news and the views from one side of the Atlantic from the perspective of the other. Today, on Saturday, July the 30th, I find myself in my home city, my hometown of Birmingham, which is now the centre of, if not the world, definitely of the Commonwealth nations, because the Commonwealth Games, this annual event which happens every 4 years, is taking place in my hometown. What is the Commonwealth? What is the future of the Commonwealth? What is Britain's place in the Commonwealth? These are things which we're going to discuss today. Today I have with me Paul Doddridge, pundit, sage, an all-round clever person, even though slightly to the right of Attila the Hunt. He's with us from Los Angeles, but originates from Wales, I believe. Your hometown is Cardiff, Paul.
Yes, it is. Why? What are you trying to imply?
No. It's just that when it comes to the Commonwealth Games, Wales is not part of the United Kingdom, and it competes by itself, just making sure that you have the proper credentials to be on this stage, sir. And then across the river, what's the river between Wales and England, David?
The River Severn.
Right. I'm just checking that we all know our geography here. That's just a quick quiz question for you. So across the River Severn, we have David Crowther, and you're in Oxfordshire, and you're going to be representing England.
Is that
right?
I didn't realise I was a rep in that sense.
Well, you know what? It's as good a title as any. So the Commonwealth is an association of some 54 countries, but is it relevant now? But first off, what exactly is the Commonwealth?
The Commonwealth is one of the world's oldest political associations. It's made up of 53 states across six continents, previously ruled by the British Empire in the 19th and 20th centuries. It has a total population of 2.4 billion people and includes countries like Canada, Australia, Nigeria, India, and much of the Caribbean. Three nations, Cameroon, Mozambique, and Rwanda, even joined despite having never been in the British Empire. Membership is voluntary and based on a shared commitment to values, including liberty, human rights, trade, and good governance. The Commonwealth Games, a sort of mini-Olympics, also takes place every 4 years. But there are questions about the relevance of this organization. Its colonial history continues to cause problems, particularly when it comes to anti-LGBT laws, still enforced in 37 member countries. Brexiteers are adamant that the Commonwealth will take on a greater importance. They're promising new trade deals and having taken back control of borders, even swapping EU for Commonwealth migration. Vincent McAvinney, Euronews, London.
Paul, I'm going to come to you. Simple question. There's utterly no right and wrong here, but what does the Commonwealth mean to you?
I think your man just summed it up, really. It is just it's a nice political association. It's just a club. just a club association of countries. I don't think it's anything too taxing or onerous, or it doesn't require seemingly a great deal of responsibility on anybody's party to be a member or not to be a member. I actually like its model, as you know, far from is it still relevant. I actually think it's a good model ongoing for Brexiteers like me. I think this is kind of the level of association we'd like amongst nations.
David Crowther, you have the podcast The History of England, and I know through listening to it, you're doing this magisterial sweep of English history. You're not quite up to the Commonwealth that we're talking about, but you're almost up to the Republican Commonwealth. What does the Commonwealth mean to you, sir?
I have to say, it's never really meant anything to me. It's quite interesting, the Commonwealth Games, I don't think I've seen more than 5 minutes of. It would have meant a lot to my mother and her generation. It's never meant anything to me, actually. So it's actually quite an interesting question to have to consider. Is it relevant, and why is it relevant?
Do you believe, David, that with the new reality, that Britain has Brexited, that this potentially, in terms of at least Britain, could breathe some new life into our role in this organisation. We have to find a role for ourselves. Brexiteers did talk about global Britain. One of the kind of surprising stats that come out of the Commonwealth is that in terms of trade, tariffs are generally, on average, 19% lower between Commonwealth countries. So it does actually foster increased trade, even though that is not ostensibly a reason for being part of the association. So maybe there is new relevancy because of that referendum in 2016.
I don't mean to be negative about the Commonwealth, particularly. I'm sounding a bit neggy. But before I say anything positive, I'd say Brexit hasn't changed the importance of our relationship with Europe, and nor will it ever. They're still our largest trading bloc. We have a shared history with Europe. So although we're no longer part of that project, and I regret that personally a lot, well, we're not. But we're still going to have to get on with them, and they're still going to be our most important relationship, I would argue. So I don't think that changes. So the question really is whether the Commonwealth of itself has got value and is going to add something different. And it seems to me that the obvious elephant in the room, if there is an elephant, is its roots. Once upon a time, empire discuss might have been a positive concept and people might have bought into it, rightly or wrongly. They increasingly won't. And whatever you do, it's always going to be there. What is the Commonwealth? It is always going to include the British Empire. You can change the structure and all the rest of it, and we'll probably talk about that. But what do you do about that? It's always there, and it's presumably going to become more and more negative association as time goes by.
Well, let's take a little walk down history lane and let's listen to some of that history.
For the first time since his illness 5 months ago, the King attends an official function. The occasion is a luncheon in honour of the visiting Commonwealth statesman. By a happy coincidence, it is held on Princess Elizabeth's 23rd birthday. In addition to goodwill messages from all over the world, the Princess receives the personal congratulations from the Dominion leaders. Spotlighting them one by one, here is Ceylon's Senator Yeki, Lester Pearson from Canada, Lakayat Ali Khan, Pakistan. Next to Mr. Attlee, Australia's Joseph Chifley, Dr. Mallon from South Africa, New Zealand's Peter Fraser, and India's Pandit Nehru. They meet to bring the unwritten constitution of the Commonwealth into line with modern concepts. Their decisions can show the world that 400 million people of many races, colors, and religions can live united in one family.
There's a real kind of sense back then that this was a family of nations, and 1949 is significant because the Commonwealth has changed from being the British Commonwealth or the British Empire with the white dominions, and we now have Pakistan, India, and Sri Lanka, though they called it Ceylon back then. Paul, Is David's assertion right that regardless of the association in the future is going to be encumbered by this imperialistic, dare I say it, white past, and we just can't move away from that?
Well, again, I don't know if David said encumbered. If he did, I just think that's slightly pejorative. It's definitely going to be part of its history. I'm a big fan of the British Empire and what it achieved worldwide, and then same with the Roman Empire, and same, you know, with the US Empire now. I sort of just think that they are the necessitated by history, the growth of empires. They're inevitable, should we say. So I don't accept that they're encumbered. I just think that they are a byproduct of that history, and all the better for it. Again, it's interesting hearing somebody, that newsreel clip you played from whatever decade it was, and you know, he was actually, do you know what year that was from, that clip you did, that final newsreel clip you played?
1949.
And you have, I am assuming, a white male British BBC representative talking about bringing together many races and ethnicities and countries under one. And I just think, okay, that's a, you know, that ideal has been kicking around for a long time. You know, we do like to think we've just invented that kind of kumbayaness, but it's nice to hear that it was actually part of the intention decades ago. We're nothing special. So, yeah, I like the British Empire, and I like, you know, future empires are inevitable. And, you know, the idea of, for me, blaming one and celebrating another is just, I think, a bit sort of naive.
Well, it has to be said, David, I want to come to you, and then we're going to go to Piotr to just join us on stage, that one of the kind of stunning things about the Commonwealth is the fact that it is this voluntary association, and most countries that entered the Commonwealth are still part of it now. And also that, and here is the truly stunning thing, Mozambique, Rwanda and Cameroon, who were never ruled by Britain, have freely decided to join. So what are they getting out of it if it's just an association which is encumbered by this dreadful British imperial past? Why would countries choose to join the Commonwealth?
Well, it's quite interesting, actually, that I see the Gabon and Togo joined last year. They were, and one is Francophone and one was an ex-German colony, so which is interesting, and then got me thinking about that. I mean, personally, I think you'd have to find a way of trying to park the British Empire. So I understand what Paul means, and I certainly agree with Paul's view about, you know, demonising the British Empire over any other empire. But nonetheless, the idea of colonisation is no longer a positive one. So I think you have to try and find a way to park that. And personally, I think, you know, you have to try and look at the organisation and the leadership. But let's say you can do that, then there are some positives. So a intranational organisations which are based around a different set of relationships than local and regional ones, or I don't know, religious ones or whatever it might be, which are cross-cultural, I think are very important. And I think that's true of us as a nation and different nations and between nations, because you have to find ways of bringing people together. So anything which brings people together across a broad range, I think, is useful. The second thing, I think the biggest thing that actually, in a way, the Commonwealth has got going for it is the English language. That is a very powerful force in bringing countries together, because it is the world's language now, and I don't think that's going to change. So there is something in that somehow, a connection across, which is, you know, non-national, non-regional, fully international. The thing exists, so you don't have to invent it. There is a relationship that gives some countries a voice on the world stage that they wouldn't necessarily have through the UN, or have a smaller voice. So it does have some things going for it, I am forced to admit.
Mr. Curzon.
Royfield, if you were trying to get everybody up here today to have a fight, is you might as well just take your ball home now. We're all reasonable and agree.
Oh, I don't want to fight about this, because I think I actually quite like the association.
Why do you even invite me then? You only ever bring me in so people can, like, throw bricks at me.
Paul, absolutely not, sir. You provide intellectual heft from time to time. Sometimes a little bit of comedy, but every now and then, you know, the odd little bit of intellectual heft. But moving on, Piotr Curzon, we live in a multipolar world. America as the hegemon isn't what it used to be. We have the rising power of China. Russia is struggling to find its place in this new world order. what says you about the Commonwealth? Can we have this loose association of some 54 countries, of which at the heart of it is civic governance, laws about democracy and free trade? Will it have a place in, let's say, the mid-21st century?
Well, you set me up, as always, so kindly, Royfield. You know, to Paul's points, I'm actually inclined to agree to a certain extent with both. The Commonwealth is something that is based on, you know, unfortunately, a pretty dark past, well, incredibly dark and unpleasant reality. But in its form as it stands, it is a very, I think, constructive force. The Commonwealth Games, the sharing of cultures, of economy, the push for democracy, albeit in different interpretations, perhaps, I think is a very powerful force. And when we are in this new multipolarity, middle powers or upper middle powers like the United Kingdom, France, and so on, for the UK to still have this sort of way to influence countries through soft power is going to be very welcomed by them. And clearly there's something appealing about the Commonwealth, because not only have we had several countries join recently, but we also have Somaliland, which is not technically a country, but it's still a sizable chunk of Somalia. We've got South Sudan, we've got Suriname, we've got Burundi and Zimbabwe, which have all applied in the past 10 or so years to join. So quite clearly, there's something here that is appealing to developing countries to the global. Now, again, it's, I think we have to keep in mind that countries are free to come and go as well. And in a world where we are seeing this growing threat of autocracy countries, I would disagree with you that China is rising. I think it has risen, but it is fleeting a little bit.
Yeah, it's still got a way to rise, though. It hasn't risen, has it? It hasn't risen. I think my tense was correct there. Well, it's still rising. Got a way to go.
Maybe, in some ways. But point being is that China doesn't have a collective system like the US does with its alliance network. And the UK, as you could argue, is the Commonwealth. Again, it's built on pretty, you know, unpleasant backgrounds. But as it stands modern day, it is a pretty powerful, you know, entity. And when Brexit was happening, before I realized just how much Brexit would be, I'm not pro Brexit. I was one who felt that the UK should have a looser relationship with the EU and have a deeper relationship with other Commonwealth countries. Now, obviously, the situation is completely different, but it still does offer the UK an opportunity to have a really good relationship with predominantly countries of South Asia and South and East Africa, which is where we're going to see the biggest amount of development. Nigeria is what going to be an energy and largely speaking a superpower of Africa in decades to come, and the UK having a unique relationship with them. Like, France doesn't have a Commonwealth system, and France's, you know, military engagement in the west of Africa, for example, in Sahel, has been large, you know, criticized and seen as a neo form of colonialism, which, whether or not you interpret it like that, but the point is that Britain does have a foothold in a way that France doesn't. And even Spain doesn't in Latin America in certain ways. So I think that the Commonwealth utilized correctly could be of great benefit to the UK specifically, but also all the countries that are a part of it. And I think we see that from the comments around it. And they do act as a way. It does act as a way for the other countries to raise issues on the UN. And again, we could talk about UN structures and reformation, but generally speaking, the UK can then have a way in influencing and bringing these issues to the table as a P5 member. So I largely, you know, I'm on the side of the Commonwealth. I don't see getting rid of it is any worth. You know, it was interesting when Barbados decided to remove the Queen as head of state. That's fair enough. I understand that. But they don't want to leave the Commonwealth. And why would they? It's you know, emphasizing good governance, equality before law, free trade, multilateralism. So, yeah, I think it's going to play a very important role for the UK as it tries to find itself in the 21st century, but also as a strong upholder of certain values and norms, which, you know, many developing countries thinking, you know, grappling with in terms of, do they want to be democracies, authoritarian regimes, hybrid, whatever it is. And the Commonwealth can help to maybe encourage more of them to adopt more democratic values. Well, that's just my piece for the time being.
Thank you for that, Mr. K. I do think this whole notion of why countries want to be part of the Commonwealth is something which we should really talk about and kind of investigate further. But first off, we do have a few new people on stage. Giacomo, welcome, sir.
Hello, I know my that friend. Hello, good to see you.
Good to see you too. I know you've spent time in London, which isn't the capital of the Commonwealth, but it's definitely a city which helped form the Commonwealth. What says to you about the Commonwealth? When I say to you the Commonwealth of Nations, what's the first thing that comes to mind?
Many good things come to mind. And by the way, I spent my formative years in England. I lived in England from the age of 14 till the age of 18. After which I left to the German-speaking part of Switzerland. But what I also never told anyone is that I have a British family, and they were Britons, and they were also, I'm afraid, aristocracy. But that's another story altogether. But the past is dead, okay? Piotr mentioned, he said, the Commonwealth might have had a dark past, perhaps. But who and what did not have a dark past throughout history? What I think Commonwealth... When I think queen and country, I only see good things. And I look at the future, I only see harmony. I only see good relations and being beneficial nations and societies being beneficial to one another. Because when we look at the British monarchy today, and for the last century or even more, it's a constitutional monarchy. It's only doing good. Otherwise, the people of Britain, of Great Britain, would have gotten rid of it long time ago. And as a republic, Great Britain would not be the same. We all know it. So I want the Commonwealth to continue. And Commonwealth is when people from India have something very strong in common with people, say, in Barbados and with people in Kenya, and in many other places. And they have at the head this wonderful monarch who reigned longer than Queen Victoria, Queen Elizabeth II. So for me, the Commonwealth is only good, and I want it to continue. I'm not looking at the past. I'm not looking even at the present. I'm looking at the future. And in a post-Brexit Britain, if Britain wants to reclaim its rightful place as a leader among nations, as an example to look forward to in various different continents around the world, be it Africa, be it Asia, be it the Americas, the Commonwealth is the great symbol of that. And with that, I'll let the stage to others. Thank you.
Prime Minister Muscat, Prime Minister May, Secretary General, ladies and gentlemen, having on so many occasions been welcomed to opening ceremonies around the Commonwealth, it is a pleasure this time to welcome you to my own home. Here at Buckingham Palace in 1949, my father met the heads of government when they ratified the London Declaration, which created the Commonwealth as we know it today, then comprising just 8 nations. Who then, or in 1952, when I became head of the Commonwealth, would have guessed that a gathering of its member states would one day number 53, or that it would comprise 2.4 billion people? Put simply, we are one of the world's great convening powers, a global association of volunteers who believe in the tangible benefits that flow from exchanging ideas and experiences and respecting each other's point of view. And we seem to be growing stronger year by year.
That was Queen Elizabeth opening, I think it was the last CHOGM, so the last Commonwealth Heads of Government Conference, not the one that just happened in Rwanda, because she was, dare I say, she's too frail actually to attend. But she did make the point at the end that we seem to be getting stronger. And I've said it a couple of times. I'm going to say this again, that Rwanda, a country which was never part of the British Empire, it was formally colonized by Germany. then Belgium. Part of its healing process to get to bring Hutsi and Tutsi together and to regain its place in the pantheon of nations was actually to join the Commonwealth. And it's not as if the Commonwealth is going out proselytizing, trying to get countries to join. But as Piotr has actually said, there are a lineup of countries that want to join, South Sudan being one of them, that see that there is benefit of being part of this association. Shashank, welcome, sir. You're in London. Why do you think these countries that weren't even ever part of the British Empire do want to join? And then also tell us, when I say the Commonwealth to you, what's the first thing that you think?
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Hey, Royfield. Good to be here. I am actually right now in Washington, D.C., traveling. I've missed first few minutes of conversation, so I didn't hear anything what Paul, David, or Piotr would have said or you would have said. But in my context, the way that I see it is that humans always want association with each other and collaboration with each other to avoid the past 1,000 years of animosity toward between nations and cultures and people. And one of the pointed ways that it works is if there is a political alliance or economic alliances, then that achieves that. Instead of having wars, we exchange. And you just played the Queen's address to one of the Chogoms, where she mentioned about exchange of ideas and exchange of experiences. And this exchange of ideas and experiences is timeless. It always fosters collaboration, coordination, and less wars. And in that context, I do not see around anywhere in the world any union, loosened union or association that does bind 2.5 billion, 3 billion people together. So from that context, the Commonwealth is not itself sell-by-date. But yes, the context of where it started with the colonial empire and everything else, etc., of course, that is no longer relevant because that empire doesn't exist. So people who live with that historic peace and they think somehow it gives an extra power to Britain in certain shape or form, that no longer exists. But the nations that want to join the Commonwealth is because they do understand the exchange of ideas and experiences and knowledge does strengthen everybody. And it's not one-way traffic, it's a two-way traffic for every nation on planet Earth. So from that context, I think that's the reason why everybody, or like the nations who are interested in it and have association with the former British Empire, that empire piece is gone, but they want to exchange ideas and science and education and development and politics and technology. And that's why it's still relevant, I think.
I couldn't agree with you more. There's a document in 1971, which is probably the high point of the political kind of activism of the Commonwealth. So in 1971, there's a Declaration of Commonwealth Principles. And the principles are thus, that we support international peace and understanding, have equal rights for all citizens, remove poverty, ignorance, and disease. These are principles which I think just about anybody can get behind. But they came about in 1971 because we have apartheid South Africa. South Africa has left the Commonwealth because of the new black African nations, which have now joined. And their position was totally incongruous to this multiracial body. So South Africa leaves before it's kicked out. And in 1971, off the back of South Africa leaving, the Commonwealth needs to have a direction. And it says, again, we're going to support international peace and understanding, equal rights for all citizens. That's important. That is pointing a finger at South Africa. We're going to try and remove poverty, ignorance, and disease. And one of the kind of key things that the Commonwealth tries to do through the Secretariat of the Foundation, the Commonwealth of Learning, and the Games Federation is to support civil society in all member states, promoting learning, whether it's distance learning and education and sport. And it seems to me that maybe the Commonwealth has breathed new life into itself, actually by the display that we had by Tom Daley walking into the arena at Alexander Park in Birmingham with that rainbow gay flag. Some 37 nations of the Commonwealth still have anti-LGBTQ plus laws. Is there any other way, anybody feel to unmute now, of which we can see that the Commonwealth can not just be a passive organisation, but maybe be an active organisation in extolling civil rights and civil access and equality throughout member nations?
It would seem to me that, you know, that in a sense there's an obvious yes. But the question is it relevant? So it's a nice thing, obviously, that's great, but it will only have force if the Commonwealth can be relevant. So is there a real raison d'etre to it, or is it just a nice talking shop? And that maybe has some value, I guess, from what people have said, and Bella's comments are very interesting. But what is it that would make people want to be active about it? So, for example, as I understand it, India is still part of the Commonwealth, but doesn't really send many delegates to any of the meetings because it's not particularly important. So how do you make it a genuine driver of change rather than just, you know, a nice thing to have?
Yeah, so I think there's an interesting dichotomy here, I think, because Britain only, legalised gay marriage about 10, 12 years ago. And up until that time, you know, chemical castration and all these things, it was abhorrent what they did to, you know, so many homosexual communities. And the UK has come a long way in areas like that. But the thing is, when you're trying to, and we were having this discussion in other, you know, areas like British exceptionalism, right? American British exceptionalism. And this is where it can get tricky, because if you try as the British, I don't know, government, the British Council is quite an important entity and all this sort of thing, to promote certain norms and values in other countries, which are still, whether or not they are democracies, because that's, you know, they've developed it. It could backfire in specifically in the role of the UK in trying to sort of improve its international standing and reputation, right? Or to be seen as a country that is moving away from its colonialist past as best as it can, not that it ever will really be able to. But if it is seen to be or perceived to be trying to say to other countries, hey, look, guys, you should legalize same-sex marriage, you should remove certain, I don't know, laws or prejudices against women in the workplace or something like that, gender equality, all that sort of social and progression. Some countries, some communities could see that as a new form of neocolonialism or something. The British, again, trying to tell countries in the Commonwealth how they should and shouldn't govern them. And so it could be a detriment. The UK has to go about it, I think, quite, not just the UK, but, you know, any country that has been on that sort of positioning has to be sensitive with the way that it goes about, because otherwise it could be misconstrued. But I do think that the Commonwealth, in essence, can play a very important role through cultural diplomacy, public diplomacy, soft power, as we mentioned before, but even smart power. So the use of hard power as a way to help countries bolster their defensive lines against countries as they perhaps, you know, there's tension over a border or something like that. Like Kenya has been quite close with the British. If you look at the Security Council in the past year since they joined, Kenya's been working quite well and quite constructively with the British over the Ethiopian file and the Tigrayan conflict. So, you know, and they definitely see that intensified or whatever, consolidated through the Commonwealth. So
Thank you for that, Piotr. And I must admit that the more I'm starting to lean into this and actually read up about the Commonwealth, I think this loose association of nations actually does wield some level of real influence with genuine outcomes. And I did mention this really at the start. I'm going to read this out again. So bilateral costs for trading partners in Commonwealth countries are on average 19% less than those of non-member countries. This is a real economic advantage of being a member, actually, of the Commonwealth. Piotr's just given us one where the Kenyans are actually working with the British in terms of looking at Ethiopia and that civil war there in Tigray. And it's because those officials actually have another forum where they get to know each other so that they can actually cooperate well together. The one thing which is slightly worrying about our conversation is we seem to be framing this as this is a way in which Britain can maintain its influence throughout the world. And it is the Commonwealth, not the British Commonwealth. And I think, hence I keep asking the question, why do other countries want to join? Why are they still part of it? Because if Nigeria wants to leave tomorrow, it can leave and no one's going to stop it leaving. But it hasn't in some 60 years plus of independence. I'll just use Nigeria as an example. Jamaica being another one. It might remove the Queen from being its head of state, but it's not going to leave the Commonwealth. That's without question. It's not going to leave. So these countries obviously do feel like they're getting something from it, away from Britain's need to redefine itself after Brexit. Cheryl, welcome on. I believe you're from Singapore, aren't you?
Hi, Royfield. So nice to connect here again. Yes, I'm Singaporean. I live in San Francisco. I mean, just a couple of thoughts about, you know, just the various things that have been discussed. For one, I think what you just mentioned, Royfield, we are subconsciously and unconsciously returning to the glory of the empire. And like, even if we say that it's no longer like the British Commonwealth, it is just the Commonwealth. We are subconsciously and unconsciously returning to that. And, you know, there's many post-colonial psychologists that have talked about this kind of psychology. It still exists. And so I think, you know, it's present. You know, even the idea of 377, you know, the anti-gay laws that were set by colonial powers. I mean, any kind of stepping in leads to, you know, an increase in fragmentation around different factions, right? Which is what was mentioned earlier. And so, I mean, as much as we try to say,
Cheryl, move forward. I really want you to make your point, but tell us exactly what 377 is, because I must admit, I don't know. Oh, so I'm sure there's okay. Other people that don't.
So the anti-gay law that was set by the, you know, colonial powers back in the day was, I believe, specifically across the colonies to manage gay prostitution back in the day. The soldiers around the colonies would sort of hire prostitutes, and it was same-sex sort of prostitution. And I think that law was specifically to manage that. So even though Britain has removed that law, you know, countries like India just removed it, Singapore still holds on to it, Malaysia does, and I believe some of the countries in the African continent still have 377. So it's sort of stuff like that, you know, like, you know, even though we say we are the Commonwealth, I think it does need some kind of revamping, because our post-colonial psychology keeps returning to the empire. It takes generations to heal from colonialism. It doesn't just end just because colonialism ends. I think it takes generations to truly define a new identity. And I don't think a lot of our countries are there yet. So I think I agree with some of the pragmatic reasons why our countries should continue to be associated, sharing science, sharing economic type, favors and things. But I think revamping it all together, somehow just kind of symbolically at least shifting away from its history a lot more and redefining who we are, I think will be a necessary thing if we really want this thing to work and not have this subconscious kind of post-colonial thing keep coming back. I think we really do need to revamp and have some kind of new identity moving forward.
I think it's going to be incredibly difficult to disassociate the origins of the Commonwealth from the British Empire. And unless we want to completely dissolve and reconstruct something else, which is based around, you know, more
equal basis, which I don't think would ever remain fully equal because everything has naturally develops a hierarchy, if you think about it. It's going to be impossible. I mean, at the end of the day, this is the thing that was created by the UK. So it's going to be incredibly difficult to sort of then say, well, the UK is not really the underlying driver of it. Maybe in many hundreds of years.
But Piotr,
I don't see it possible.
I'm going to disagree with you respectfully here, because I think that with the passing of the current head of the Commonwealth, Queen Elizabeth II, it's at best it's 50-50 that Charles will actually become the head of the Commonwealth going forward. It's actually not written into any statute of the Commonwealth that the head of state of Britain actually is the head of the Commonwealth. It actually isn't. It surprised me. It was just taken as a given. And I think him not being the next head of the Commonwealth would be a very powerful symbolic break with Britain being, let's say, the first amongst equals in terms of the Commonwealth. And I think it's very, and the British government, at least since the early 1970s, has really just let the Commonwealth drift because we were enmeshed in with the European Economic Community, that we saw that for all of the cheap butter we can get from New Zealand or cheap lamb and whatever, fundamentally, as David Crowther said at the start of this, Europe is our largest trading partner. However, Britain now does have a reason to, let's say, engage a little bit more with this association of 54 countries, of which I would less say that Britain is the center of it, but the English language most definitely is. N, welcome to the stage. Hello. First off, tell us, are you either a Commonwealth citizen or are you sat in a Commonwealth country?
So right now, I'm in Hong Kong. I'm holding a British national overseas passport. It's not exactly a British passport, but it's a colonial legacy. Essentially, I don't have the rights of a Brit. But yeah, somehow I hold a British passport.
Well,
yeah.
You are welcome on this stage, sir, and you have as more right than most in this room to be talking about the legacy of the Commonwealth. So Hong Kong is not now part of the Commonwealth, but there still are colonial ramifications and legacies, of which you've just explained one. You have a passport. Yeah. So when we talk about the Commonwealth, what's the first thing that comes to your mind? What does the Commonwealth mean to you?
So yeah, I was born in Hong Kong probably 35 years ago. Yeah, it was a colony back then. And as you guys probably know, Hong Kong was returned to China in 1997. And there is a big debate going on before and after 1997, you know, whether people in Hong Kong should become part of the Commonwealth or become British citizens. So yeah, I think ultimately, you know, Hong Kongers have no right to become a Brit. And yeah, I think as you guys know, back in 2019, there was a big crackdown, you know, by China in Hong Kong, trampling on individual rights, implementing really draconian security law. And starting from 2021, I believe, you know, Britain, the UK, you know, roll out a BNO scheme, essentially allowing people who were born before 1997, you know, during the colonial era, to be able to come to UK. Know, sort of like a lifeboat. Yeah, so that's what it means to me, you know. I'll actually come to the UK because of that, you know, like the Ukrainians.
Do you believe that Britain, post the handover or the return of China of Hong Kong and the new territories, should have been a larger voice for democracy in Hong Kong?
Yeah, definitely. I think, yeah, our last governor, Chris Patten, you know, wrote many books on it. You know, I think he wrote a new book recently, Hong Kong Diaries, you know, about how, you know, sort of the UK let down people in Hong Kong, you know, the UK ruled Hong Kong for 100 years. I think some of the Chinese will say, oh, it's sort of a colonial humiliation. But for the people in Hong Kong, you know, they started in Hong Kong under colonial rule, you know, since that, you know, we have the same education, we have the same legal system. So yeah, I think to a certain extent, you know, the UK back then, I think, failed to fulfill the moral responsibility or the moral obligations. So I guess for me, strangely, you know, Hong Kong is an exception of UK's colonial rule. You know, Hong Kong thrived back then, and probably now, but not to the full extent. So, yeah, you know, to me, the Commonwealth is sort of like a beacon of democracy, you know, beacon of freedom. I think the Africans or the Indians may not agree with me, you know, but, you know, that's just my perspective, I guess. Yeah.
Well, your perspective is incredibly valid, and you qualify it by saying that you're actually from Hong Kong. But first, I'm going to go to Paul Doddridge, because, Paul, I know you've been itching to jump in. So we're going to go Paul, then we're going to go to Giacomo.
I just wanted to ramble through as quickly as possible some boring points, because there was no conflict earlier. But weirdly, I always like to argue with Roy Field. I'm actually anti-monarchy. See, this is the weird thing. It's like exactly the reverse of what you were suggesting. I'm anti the monarchy in the UK, but very pro-empire and colonialism. If basically, there's a lot of tone around this subject, like, if you basically lost out to an expanding empire, somehow that you nursed that grievance forever and an injustice was done. It's like, you could have fought back. You could have won. You didn't, you know? We don't complain about the Roman Empire. We don't complain about the Normans invading or the Vikings or whatever. Everybody has a go. Most of the countries that are actually in the Commonwealth at some point would have...
So you believe in geopolitical Darwinism? And that might is right, whatever.
100%, which is what I was going to come to. So the whole thing about, you know, we do sort of nurse our credentials, our virtue, and we sing kumbaya. We don't really give a monkeys about human rights, etc. It's kind of nonsense. That, you know, you can see how we behave. We wouldn't deal with Saudi Arabia if we did. The whole thing is always, it's the economy, stupid. And the fact is that the Commonwealth has got 2.5 billion people in it, and they are rejoining, or countries are coming to join the Commonwealth again, because it's more than the EU. We left the customs union. We can now import tariff-free their produce, and we can now sell to 2.5 billion people. But we can import, and that's the thing. We have one of the reserve currencies on earth, and we can actually buy. And so if the EU want to make our purchases difficult with them, there are people queuing up around the world, actual produce countries, which many of these are, famously all the stuff with the coffee beans going to Germany and then African countries being ripped off by them. We can actually buy direct without the onerous customs union tariffs. So that's at the heart of everything. It's always the economy. It's always might is right. And I was going to say the same thing with Hong Kong. I mean, Hong Kong, we leased it. We had to give it back. If we hadn't have given it back, there would have been a war. We leased it from an imperial country, and then that was taken over by communism. But it was still China. You know, we did actually honor a 100-year lease, and it's just like anything else would have been madness. We do comfort ourselves, I think, too much in the West, like we're some sort of benign, magnanimous kind of Benetton commercial kind of sensibility. We're not. We're as rapacious and economy driven as any other country on earth. That's me.
Geopolitical Darwinism, as given to you by Paul Doddridge. Paul Doddridge, thank you for coming onto the stage. I knew we'd disagree about something eventually, and I violently disagree with you, sir, but I appreciate you coming onto the stage. We have now Hanson. Hanson, first off, we're just qualifying here. First off, what country are you sat in, Hanson, and are you a Commonwealth citizen?
No, I'm American, your first cousin.
All right, Anson, what is your point, sir?
I like that.
So, yeah, I think Commonwealth is a fantastic institution and organization. I don't see an expiration date on it yet.
All right, very quickly, then we're going to come to Giacomo. Tell us why you don't see an expiration date on the Commonwealth. And are you now of the mind, Hanson, that those 13 colonies all should leave the United States and sign up for the Commonwealth tomorrow?
13 colony. Didn't get that part. 13 what? Sorry.
The original 13 colonies that broke away to form the United States. Being silly. It's the stripes on your flag. The stripes on your flag.
Of course. Yes, of course. Yes. Your question is whether they should have left the...
I suppose the question is, why don't you see that there is an expiration date on the Commonwealth?
I think it has proved its vibrancy and longevity through all the prosperities of all the of all the family members within the Commonwealth, and of course the United States. The United States is not part of it, but yet it has inherited the spirit, especially the Magna Carta. The United States Constitution is a natural outgrowth or extension of the Magna Carta, and I think that is the lifeline, bloodline of all the prosperity within the Commonwealth, and then also, just as I think B mentioned, you can see the difference between a stark difference before and after the Hong Kong cessation, or not cessation, sorry, the departure from the Commonwealth. So that one example is sufficient to prove the let's say the root of all the prosperity, which is this organization.
There is something in it in terms of signing up to the Commonwealth. If we look at the countries who are amongst the highest performing of the Ibrahim Index of African Governance, 7 out of the top 10 are Commonwealth nations. If we look at, again, in sub-Saharan Africa, I'm just using these as there's a whole load of data and stats here. But if you look at the Commonwealth countries in sub-Saharan Africa, 7 of the top 10 are the highest performing countries in terms of gender equality. That's not to say that they don't have a way to go. But by lots of many metrics and indices, a lot of those Commonwealth countries do much better than their non-Commonwealth neighbors.
I wanted to remind everyone that in the beginning of the 20th century, 1/4 of the globe, 25% of the globe across all continents, hoisted the Union Jack. Okay?
And you mean had it foisted upon them, you mean?
Yes. The Union Jack floated in 25% of the globe, whether we, for good or bad, whether we want to recognize it or not, it's a fact. Okay? And that is a legacy. That is a common heritage. And you cannot erase a common legacy, a common culture, you have to look at all the good that came out of it. And unfortunately, as a few of you mentioned, during the years that Great Britain was part of the European Union, the Commonwealth organization was, an association was neglected. And now that Britain is Britain again, I think that relationship should be explored to its fullest extent. And no, the colonialism of past years is gone. I mean, look at India today. My God, 1.2 billion people. Look at Nigeria, one of the most powerful countries on the African continent, a major, major petroleum exporter and so on and so forth. They will have no inferiority complex when they are sitting at the table with the representative of Great Britain. It can be used to everyone's advantage. And slowly, slowly, the domination of Great Britain on the Commonwealth group of nations is waning. And my friends, I was in Hong Kong first in 1987, 88, 89, and I was there still in 96. And I remember at the time, one of the main tasks of Great Britain was to give back Hong Kong and make sure not to act as a former colonial master and disappear as quietly and with as dignified a manner as possible, because China was a huge rising power. And the last thing that Great Britain wanted to do was to appear as a former arrogant colonial master. That's why it's sent there to the lowering of the flag and everything, Prince Charles. And I remember at the time he played that role beautifully. That's all I have to say for now. Thank you.
Thank you for that, Giacomo. Now, you did say you wanted to jump in, but let's just welcome new people onto the stage. Bijan, and then we're going to go to you. So, Bijan, welcome. I'm going to ask you the question which I've asked new arrival to the stage. Do you hold a Commonwealth passport, or are you set in a Commonwealth country?
Hi, everyone. Well, I hold a British passport, although I feel a world citizen. if that makes me welcome to this room, then I can carry on.
Everybody's welcome, sir. It's just a way of qualifying people's insight when it comes to the Commonwealth. But a global citizen most definitely can and is welcome in this room. So far away, what's your point, BJ?
Well, when you're talking about, I mean, your title, your really this title of if this the Commonwealth is still, you know, relevant, it doesn't look so. I mean, we are born free, and having, you know, on your flag, although I'm not for flags and symbols, having the flag of someone else just in the corner, it reminds those years of colonialism, and it's not changing. I mean, if India wants to have a relation with Kenya or Nigeria, they are independent nations. They can do it without a middleman. With all respect to the royal family, the Queen, wonderful lady.
But Bijan, but they do. They absolutely do. If India wants to have a bilateral trade agreement with Kenya and Kenya says we'd like to have one in India, they don't refer to Buckingham Palace or to the British government. They get on and do it. The point is, though, that because every 2 years their governments sit down next to each other and they loosely coordinate on other matters like civil governance. The Commonwealth has seen 140 elections since 1970. This fosters familiarity, but the British royal family or the British government is not mediating between, let's say, a trade deal between India and Kenya. But you know what? That trade deal will be written in English. There's going to be certain terms, judicial terms, which are inherent in both countries. So they're kind of speaking not only the same language, but the same business language. That's the point.
Well, you see, those words that you just said, with all respect to the judicial terms, are on the colonial basis of another country, and it's going to be British. How do you explain that a country who cannot unite with its neighbor, and it has done that self-harm of Brexit, who wanted to become, you know, a second Singapore of Europe, and, you know, make Britain greater and take control, is now a mess. With all respect, I suffer to see.
How can the UK export the idea of being a loose association of sovereign nations because it is now leaving something that isn't a loose association of sovereign nations? It's exactly because of what it's done that it can actually hold its head up high in the Commonwealth. Other sovereign nations not becoming one supranationally controlled super state. That's the whole point.
Super state? I mean, do you see a world of today with a super state? I mean,
the EU,
what do you mean?
The minute the EU, the Commonwealth countries cannot, just because they're a member of the Commonwealth, they can't go and live and have rights of residencies in each other's countries. Every member of the EU can. That's a supranational government. That's a document that says you're part of one country. Commonwealth is not.
That is common sense. That is not Commonwealth. You know, 27 countries in Europe, they have given a chance to the new generation and to the people now that to move around, to live there freely, to work there without any paperwork, without any bureaucracy. Look what happened this summer just for the travelers.
Yes, and it's a bad idea. It's a bad idea. That's what I'm saying. Yes, they've turned into one amount.
All right.
There is one thing that you don't understand about the European Union.
Giacomo, everybody, one second. Bijan, it is actually incorrect to say that any EU citizen can move to any EU country with no paperwork. For a start off, yes, you are free to move, but if you move to Belgium, you have to submit to the local police station that you've moved there from what country and you need to show paperwork. You have the right to move there, do not get me wrong, but it's wrong to say you can move without any paperwork because Belgium will kick you out straight away. Anyway, on that point, Bijan, American common law is derived from English common law. Are you then saying right? To your point that this is a colonial legacy, that when America enters into, let's say, a trade agreement with, I don't know, St. Kitts in the West Indies, that the very fact that both parties are speaking English and both documents will kind of roughly measure up to each other because they're written with the same kind of common law, business law, etc. This is a colonial legacy and it needs to be thrown out.
Not about throwing out, but I refuse to remember Australia, I don't know which was the year, they made a referendum just to kick the Commonwealth out to get
It wasn't a referendum about the Commonwealth. It was a referendum about the monarchy, of which, because the Republican side was divided in terms of the system of governance, would there be a direct election to the president, or would the president be elected from Parliament, that the Republican side lost because they couldn't actually get their act together as to how they'd actually replace the head of state, who's also the British head of state. But the one thing about this conversation, I don't just mean with you, Bijan, but I'm going to say with a lot of people, which is a little bit dispiriting, that we're focusing so much on Britain here, and we kind of seem to be ignoring, though BN did, that there are 53 other countries who are free to leave this association that don't, and more countries want to join. So I take the lessons about British imperialism. As somebody who has an English surname, even though my ancestors were slaves, British imperialism is in my name. My surname should not be Brown. It should be an African one. So I take all of those points, but still we have a free association of countries and the list is growing. The question should be why, and they all can't be signing up to be part of a British imperialistic club. Piotr, go for it. The floor is yours, sir.
Thanks. Oh my God, I'm going to start banging my head against the wall if I hear any other statements made in a minute. The Commonwealth is a political association of number one. The EU is a supranational organization made up of sovereign states which combine elements of fiscal, monetary, political, and economic policy. So they are not the same, and we should not be comparing them together as was attempted to be made. The statement that you can move freely beyond the EU with any paperwork, I mean, no, that's not true. You need documentation. Once you're in the Schengen area, then you can move freely within the Schengen area, but you need a certain visa. As lovely Brexit has made, I now have to get a visa every time I want to go to the European Union. And because some people in the country decided, yes, let's leave the EU, I now can't live and work there. So thank you very much. But aside from that, the Commonwealth is something that, whether or not you like it, is going to still be grounded in the former past of colonialism. We can move past that, and we should. These points that are being made in the comment section by others about, you know, communism being bad and everything that has come to pass about it, and, you know, the Roman Empire and all this sort of stuff. Yeah, everybody's done bad shit, and we need to move, you know, we need to focus on trying to, well, build the Commonwealth up into something better. I'm on board with Paul's realpolitik approach to a point, which is that, yes, we are pretty self-interested. And what are we driven by? We are driven by our own vested interests. First and foremost, realism continues to be the dominant theory in international relations for a reason. And any idealist, any liberalist who says that, you know, the idea of international cooperation is brilliant and amazing, sure, yeah, in theory it is, but in reality, what happens when push comes to shove, we see realism coming back with a vengeance, and that is the case with the Commonwealth. In its purest form, it's trying to be altruistic, it's trying to be liberalist and say we can bring countries together to work together and move on from the dark past that it is originated from. But in reality as well, it's an economic benefit for a lot of the countries, and particularly the United Kingdom. So the UK is still, whether or not there is a new head of state who then is the head of the Commonwealth, that could be an interesting way to diversify the power structure, but you're not going to be able to disassociate the fact that this thing is born and bred from the original British Empire. And I think, just on a side note, Brexit was a fucking terrible idea because we've lost an economic market of about 500 million people. And the UK was not actually in the UK's, in the EU system as the Leave campaign tried to perceive it. It was all smoke and mirrors, all bollocks. And the UK, because of it, has now probably lost about
8 to 10% worth of growth over the next 10 to 15 years. We've already seen a 1.5% reduction in the past year and a half, and that's not even taking into account COVID. So no, leaving was a terrible idea. We should have stayed in the system and improved it from within. And any financially responsible nations like, say, Greece or the pigs, as they were frankly unpleasantly known, weren't going to affect the UK economy because they don't have the same currency. The euro crisis was bad for the British economy in an aggregate sense, but specifically from a fiscal and monetary aspect, the UK got off relatively well. Anyway,
I love the fact that we've had this level of passion about the Commonwealth. Utterly, utterly love that. What I am going to do now, though, and I haven't said this at all, I've been so engrossed with this whole conversation, is actually remind people, this is actually recording of the podcast Mid-Atlantic, where we look at the news and the views from one side of the Atlantic from the perspective of the other. At least that's what we do normally. So on that note, what I'm going to do, please indulge me, everybody. I'm going to play one last clip, and then I'm going to wrap up the recording of the podcast. However, I'll still keep this room going for about another 10 to 15 minutes. So after Piotr Curzon's impassioned screed against Brexit, we go to this clip.
It's time now for the 2022 Commonwealth Games opening ceremony here at the Alexander Stadium in Birmingham. Let's hand you over to Hazel Irvin and Andrew Cotter.
Now, this is the way to arrive in the stadium, a rich history of car manufacturing in the Midlands. The Prince of Wales and the Duchess of Cornwall to represent Her Majesty the Queen tonight. Now time to meet Stella and the Dreamers.
And they're going to meet some of the key figures from Brum's history.
Worcester's dear Edward Elgar dreamed the music of our nation.
We'll talk about the Midlands' claim to Charlie Chaplin.
Samuel Johnson.
8 years to compile 40,000 words.
For his dictionary.
When I first came to this city, I had never heard its name, but I would come to understand it through the doctors and nurses at the Queen Elizabeth Hospital. It is my honor to say, welcome to Birmingham.
Welcome to Birmingham. The Birmingham has played host to 2.5 billion people, in effect, with its hosting of the Commonwealth Games. And I suppose on a day-to-day basis, this is the one legacy that comes redolent in the afterglow of empire. It is the Commonwealth Games. It used to be called the Friendly Games, which happens once every 4 years. It travels all around the world, just like host cities that host the Olympics do. But it travels around the world, but specifically and only to Commonwealth countries. I must admit, as a child of empire, somebody comes wrapped up in black skin who has an English surname, the Commonwealth does mean something to me, and something which, yes, is dripped in blood of the past and the sweat of, let's say, my ancestors, but many other nations. But also, I think there is a potential for the future where countries can meet each other as equals, but have a loose familial association. One of the clips which we had, which is from 1949, did talk about a family of nations. And whether it's nations that play sport together, cricket or rugby, or nations who happen to speak the same language, there is something almost intangible, but then is made tangible by those activities which binds them together. So as somebody who is a product of the British Empire, my parents left their home country of Jamaica to go to the motherland, as they saw it in the 1960s, to go to England to go and work and to help build the economy of that. I hope that there is a future, a real warm future for the Commonwealth. And I think it's incredibly fitting that my home city of Birmingham has put on a wonderful display to open the Commonwealth Games, because if ever there is a city in the United Kingdom which is a Commonwealth city, it is actually Birmingham. The population of Birmingham is majority minority, which means that over 50% of the inhabitants of Birmingham are not white. It's made up by people from the Indian subcontinent, from South Asia, from Hong Kong, from the West Indies, and from Africa, but also from bits of the EU. There are lots of Bulgarians and Polish people that live in Birmingham. And Birmingham is a crazily diverse place. And because of that, it's actually a very young city and a city with lots of boundless energy. And yes, we should always look back for the lessons of the past, but also we should look forward with hope and with optimism. So I say, I hope that there is a future for the Commonwealth, that it's going to be relevant, not only for Britain, but still it's going to be relevant for the country of my parents' birth, Jamaica or Nigeria, or for Malaysia or for Guyana. That there's got to be a reason that they all are part of this association and then get something from it. So on that note, I would like to say, David Crowther, what's the name of your podcast, David? So just so if people want to check it out.
It's The History of England.
Piotr Curzon, it's always great to have you on stage, and it's great when you get impassioned. Where can people catch up with you online?
Well, you can find me on my Twitter. It's pcurzon, so P-K-U-R-Z-I-N. I hold spaces and I'm quite active on there now. But you also have my podcast, which I only launched two months ago because of the sit-rep room in Ukraine. That's called The Global Gambit, and you can find any directory. We do have a guest coming on next week, actually, in the form of Francis Fukuyama. To the end of
history, wow. Right there. So
I look forward to that one with hopefully you as president, Royfield.
Listen, I'm a big fan. Cheryl, thank you for joining us. It was great to have somebody from Malaysia. BN, we thank you for reminding us about the legacy of Hong Kong. Hanson, you gave us great asides. Don't forget, people, left of centre politics is right-thinking politics. We don't demonise our right-leaning brothers and sisters. We try and win them over the strength of our argument. Mid-Atlantic is an inclusive place. Take care, look after yourselves. Bye-bye.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.